Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to film sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Film lovers, welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. And before we begin, I want to say thank you to everybody who helped during the WFYI Fall Pledge Drive. It's because of support from listeners like you that you keep shows like Film Sociology and The Blues House Party and Stolen Moments and Curious Mix and other shows that don't have me involved with them. You keep those shows on the air on HD1 and HD2. So thank you so much. And never forget, it is never too late or too early to support WFYI, so go to WFYI.org/give anytime, and thank you. All right, full disclosure, didn't get a chance to see anything this week because of Pledge Drive Week, also the fact that I am in a show, I'm rehearsing a play that opens in a few weeks. In the shameless plug department, I will be playing Professor Van Helsing in Richmond Civic Theater's production of Dracula, which opens on October 19th. So you can go to gorct.org for a lot of that info if you want to make the trip to the eastern side of the state. But I wanted to start the bulk of the show with a podcast that was aired on Snap Judgment last weekend. And it was a fascinating look at the history of the Mondo documentary Faces of Death. Now, if you're my age, you know of this film if you've not actually experienced it yourself. I actually remember renting it. Also having a sound conversation with my father about this film, which many people took as real. And I was given a talk about this film very similar to the aspects of professional wrestling, because if guys or ladies were actually hitting themselves at the full force that that wrestling implies, or that there's that many violent acts going on in a ring, somebody would seriously be hurt, and or the police would have arrived by now. And we found out, if those of you who stayed through all the credits of Faces of Death, that there's a little trickery going on, but not too many people noticed that and or cared or just didn't know. So anyway, with that in mind, let's listen to Snap Judgment's podcast, which has been edited for certain words, about the history of the scary documentary Faces of Death. Enjoy.
Sure, I talk a big game about wanting to see the movie. I'm in high school, so I talk a big game about a lot of stuff. And there's no way I can actually see it. It's contraband. It's forbidden. especially in our conservative church community. But then one night, staying over at my best buddy Craig Sterling's place, late Saturday, we're playing video games when Craig's brother, Kurt, comes downstairs and he's waving a black cassette tape. Both of us know what it is before he even opens his mouth. From WNYC Studios, Snap Judgment proudly presents Unthinkable. My name is Glenn Washington. In just a moment, you will understand why peer pressure is the worst kind of pressure. Because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Snappers, fasten your seatbelts because today, producer John Facile takes us on an epic journey through the making and legacy of one of the most controversial films of all time. A film so infamous, it's become an urban legend. But before we get started, please listen up. This episode is not for children or sensitive listeners. Every single trigger warning in the trigger warning book applies to this episode. We'll return to regular programming next week, I promise. If this sounds like something you cannot handle, turn off the radio, unplug your headphones, back slowly away from the audio device. Feel me? Snap Judgment.
So after shooting a particularly difficult scene, I told my crew we'd go to my house, which is on the beach, and we could relax. When we got there, the crew kind of went into my living room and got a drink. My camera guy and I said, well, let's go jump in the ocean, maybe do a little body surfing, because it was pretty decent surf in front of my house. Got our trunks on, ran out, jumped in the ocean, and we're body surfing, and we bump into a dead body. A lot of times is a body that's been in the water for quite some time is filled with gas, and at that time it was kind of floating on the surface, and I said, oh my God, and we watched this body, and it kind of bobbed around, and the ocean was taking it into the shore, and I told my camera guy, I said, go get the cameras and go get the crew, bring them out here, let's film this.
This is Conan. Conan is not his real name. Before he found himself filming dead bodies, Conan was just like any other kid growing up in Southern California in the 60s. Except his dad had this pretty cool job. He hosted nature shows on TV.
There are all kinds of animals all over the world.
Conan joined the business early. He dropped out of high school to work at his dad's company.
I learned how to load cameras. I learned how to edit. I was a cameraman for about 10 years. And then I started producing my own shows.
And then, one day in the mid-70s, a man from a Japanese film company showed up at Conan's office with an unusual proposition. He said,
hey, you guys have all these nature films. You must have some animals that are being killed.
He wanted Conan to make a follow-up to a documentary called The Great Hunt, which was composed entirely of footage of animals dying.
People killing animals all over the world and how animals were taken for food, basically.
This was a very particular style of documentary called Mondo, created by the famous gruesome film Mondo Cane.
And I loved Mondo Cane.
You have never in your life seen a film like Mondo Cane.
There was all kinds of different things in Mondo Cane.
The film is a collection of obscure rituals from all over the world.
They coined the term shockumentary.
And there's lots of animal slaughter. Remember, Conan's dad hosted nature shows, so they had tons of this kind of footage. But Conan was tired of making nature films. he wanted to do something more ambitious.
So I suggested, why don't we do something about humans getting killed? I'm fascinated by death, and growing up, death was something you did never talk about, and grandpa passed away. Well, how did he pass away? What happened?
One of Conan's favorite scenes in the original Mondo Kane deals with this very subject.
I think it was in China, but they were the death houses where the elderly people went to die.
The hopelessly sick are all brought here in this tragic boarding house for the dying.
That stuck with me.
So Conan came up with a plan to sell the Japanese on a documentary that would explore the many faces of death using real, shocking footage. Footage that movie-going audiences had never seen before.
So I went and got a doctor friend of mine who had access to a morgue, and I went and shot an autopsy.
He cut that material together with some other graphic footage.
The Japanese had flown out, and we had a screening room, and we showed them that stuff, and they just went bat crazy. They were so excited. And that's how Faces of Death came about.
For the first time in cinema history, the greatest fear of all mankind will be graphically exposed.
Conan had no idea what he was about to unleash.
Now, a motion picture dares to take you beyond the threshold of the living, where you may discover your own face of death.
Faces of Death.
It has shocked and horrified millions of viewers.
The film was supposedly banned in 40 countries.
Banned in 40 plus countries.
It was as if somebody just kind of dropped a dark cloud over me.
Yeah, let's have fun. And what is the fun? Watch people get cut up. Watch people die.
A 15-year-old accused of killing a classmate with a baseball bat just for the thrill of it.
Why are they filming this? Why are they doing this? What is wrong with people?
Roll in and action.
If you have never thought about death, it's time you started thinking. Faces of Death. Now a major motion picture.
Faces of Death is the shockumentary of shockumentaries. It's legendary. Conan was in his mid-20s when he started making the film, and he didn't really think about what its impact might be.
I was quite young when I made the first film, so to me it was just kind of a fun experiment. Can I do this? Can I pull this off? And I knew there was a lot of news material out there that had, you know, was hidden away and hadn't been touched that I could get my hands on.
When Conan first started making Faces of Death, he went door to door to different news organizations
and asked to look at the grossest footage ever. And we lucked out on a couple things. There was the PSA air crash that happened, and we asked to look at the footage, and they had the reel to show us. A young intern who my writer and I both flirted with a little bit to try and get her to show us more, she said, well, there is a tape called Body Parts. And I said, that's the tape we'd actually like to look at. So she pulled that out, and boy, did it have body parts in it.
He gathered a lot of this kind of stuff. But this was pre-smartphones, pre-digital cameras, pre-internet. And he couldn't get enough material for a feature-length film. So Conan knew he was going to have to shoot stage sequences.
The film was scripted. It was storyboarded.
The film is introduced by a quote-unquote doctor who comes out in scrubs.
I'm Dr. Francis Gross. I work as a pathologist. And over the past 20 years, I've compiled a library of the many faces of death.
Dr. Gross, as you may have guessed, is played by an actor. The film is a hybrid of staged scenes, shot by a camera crew, and real documentary footage. For example, Conan acquired this one awful shot of a woman taking her own life. She jumped off the side of a building.
But there was nothing leading up to her jumping off and no aftermath. It was just a 50-second or 40-second piece of footage.
Does a full moon affect the psyche of a human being?
We knew exactly what she was wearing. We matched that. We got an actress. We got the police and did a whole bit based on what actually happened of the police running up into the apartment, knocking on the door, trying to talk her off the ledge. She jumps.
Here's where they insert the actual footage of this woman falling to her death.
And then we picked up with, again, dramatized footage of the ambulance and scraping her brains off the sidewalk.
But many of the most violent, most talked about scenes in the film are just completely fake, though many people, to this day, still believe that they're real. The scene with the electric chair, for example.
The fellow that played the part was a professional actor. He went on talk shows and tried to describe what it was like and playing the part, and a lot of people would call in and say, "We don't believe you. It was real."
The Al-Aram restaurant in the Middle East presented
the part where people eat monkey brains.
We had several different monkey heads, and inside the monkey head was a plaster Paris skull, and inside the skull was jello and cauliflower and other stuff to simulate the brain.
Conan himself appears in the film, playing a masked, gun-toting French assassin.
My name is François Jardin. I'm a Harold assassin.
Did you think that people would think it was real?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Were you worried about that at all?
Well, there's a disclaimer in the credits at the very end, which says something like certain exiguous scenes were recreated to further document their factual origin. No one could come back and say, "Well, you said this was all real." Well, actually, no, we didn't. We said that we simulated some stuff, but it was in legalese that most people couldn't fully understand.
The credits are filled with pseudonyms. Not all of Conan's crew members wanted their name on Faces of Death. Conan didn't even want his real name on the film, which is how he ended up with
Conan Le Killer,
which is French for
Conan Le Killer.
Or at least, it sounds like it could be French for Conan the Killer. But that's not what Le Killer means.
No, I don't know what it means. I don't even know if it's a proper French name.
Faces of Death was shot over 4 to 5 weeks. There were a couple of times during the shoot where life and art overlapped, like when Conan and his camera guy were body surfing and bumped into a dead body.
This young man was at the prime of his life. Maybe he took too much for granted.
And this whole time, Conan's mother was in the hospital, dying of cancer.
I would leave filming probably 7-8 o'clock at night and ride my motorcycle to the hospital where my mother was at and go to her bedside and then hold her hand and try to talk to her when she was lucid. And it was one of the most difficult things to do in my life. When you see your mother dying and you see all the death that I'd seen in the last previous months producing Faces of Death, it gave me a little different outlook.
In a world with no sound, their cries go unheard. The reality of life becomes totally absurd.
Being in the morgue week after week and filming so many dead bodies, there wasn't any fear. There wasn't any terror to me. It wasn't even gross, except for the smell. The smell was pretty nasty. These were just shells of people that had passed and their souls had gone on to a better place.
All of this might help explain the film's surprisingly warm ending.
There's a sequence at the very end of the film with a song that's about life and rebirth.
Life goes on.
It starts with the scene of a woman having a baby and goes into the scene with the baby and then the mother in a hot tub holding the baby, and there's a song that plays, "Life Goes On." And I think that all came out of my mother's death, that even though there's death, life does go on. It's not really the end.
For your life and what life means.
Well,
Well, what about this thing that it's kind of like you're capitalizing on people's suffering?
Well, people suffer and people die. We had a buyer that wanted to buy a film that was going to pull people into their movie theaters in Japan.
In 1978, Faces of Death was released theatrically in Japan under the title Junk.
In Japan, it blew everything else away. I think it tied box office with Star Wars when it was originally released.
I don't know about the Star Wars thing, but it did kill at the box office there.
That's crazy. Who would have thought that? And then the phenomena actually didn't happen then.
The phenomena happened a few years later, when Faces of Death became widely available in the U.S., thanks to a revolutionary new piece of video technology.
Experience Panasonic VHS Hi-Fi.
VHS. By 1987, there were 42 million VCRs in the U.S.
They released it as a home video, and it was during that time that the U.S. became aware of the film, became interested in the film, critics became outraged.
We're going to expand our weekly video segment to take you into the back shelves of your local video store, back where it says horror videos and where kids are devouring some awful films that we call the video nasties.
Siskel and Ebert did a whole episode on video nasties, the violent, low-budget horror movies that were flooding VHS rental stores.
And kids are renting them voraciously and holding video nasty parties in their homes to see if they are man enough or woman enough to sit through all this disgusting gore. The trend is so popular that some stores have devoted entire shelves to this gory stuff under the horror label, but this isn't regular horror pictures. This is stuff that is simply blood and guts. And the most popular nasty of them all is a piece of trash called Faces of Death.
The film's VHS packaging was a horror movie fan's wet dream. A black box with Faces of Death in big red letters next to a skull and a banner over it that read, "Banned in 46 countries."
And that kind of added to the mystique. It was banned. It must be something I want to see.
The film was banned, at least in England. And there was some talk of banning the film in the U.S. Legislation was introduced in several states to keep it out of the hands of minors.
People were saying all kinds of things about the film, that people were killed in the film, that it was a snuff film.
Some rental stores refused to carry it. Others kept it behind the counter.
A lot of these little video stores couldn't get it, so their copy was a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy, and pretty grainy, and that lends itself to the whole fiction of being a snuff film.
It's hard to believe, and I don't believe, that parents are really aware of what's contained in those films.
Yeah. Let's have fun. And what is the fun? Watch people get cut up, watch people die. And the effect is that you confuse pain with entertainment.
Psychiatrists debated the merits of Faces of Death. Some worried the film could desensitize viewers and interfere with the development of children and their attitude toward death. And that's kind of what happened. The release of Faces of Death did have serious real-world consequences. And the first one I want to tell you about happened in 1985 at Escondido High School in Southern California.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the unthinkable episode. Today, what happens when you make a movie so shocking, so horrible, that it changes the lives of the people who watch it? Producer John Facile takes us beyond Faces of Death.
I was in the 10th grade, yes. It was over 30 years ago, so I'm trying to remember.
Sherry was actually a junior. It was the end of the year. She'd just finished her math finals. There was some downtime. So her teacher, Mr. Schwartz, wheeled out a TV stand and started playing videotapes for his students.
The first one was Rambo First Blood, and then he put the Faces of Death movie in. Almost immediately, there was a huge reaction from the class. The boys were, you know, like, oh, cool, or hey, that's awesome. But as the movie progressed, the class became more and more silent. At one point, myself and another student, Diane, asked to leave.
This is Diane.
It was pretty gross, pretty disturbing. I didn't want to watch it.
And he said that we couldn't.
He told me no, that we were going to have to stay and watch that movie. And then he kind of took my chair and swung it around on the floor to face the TV.
And so we were forced to sit and deal with this entire movie.
I remember parts of an autopsy, something about monkeys and they were bashing their heads or something.
They gave all of the people at the table a hammer, and the people at the table proceeded to beat this monkey over the head with a hammer until it died, and then they would cut the top of the head off and eat its brains. That one bothered me the most because I really love animals.
I just remember feeling icky. For lack of a better term, it just felt really icky.
It was as if somebody just kind of dropped a dark cloud over me. And I remember it being like that pretty much the rest of the week.
When Diane went home that day, she told her mom what happened.
My mom was cleaning the house. It was funny. She always wore this little bandana when she was cleaning. That was like, okay, mom is cleaning. I was just telling her about my day, and I'm like, well, you know, you wouldn't believe what Schwartz did today. And, you know, I was just kind of describing it. She stopped what she was doing, and she, you know, her mouth kind of, she's like, what? And I kind of knew at that point, I thought, oh, crap. I knew she was pissed. She put her cleaning stuff down and got her car keys, and she went to talk to the principal about this. She thought that it was pretty inappropriate. He basically told her to go back and clean her house and let him take care of the school. That was not a satisfactory answer for her, so she decided to go to the video store. There was a video store around the corner from the school.
You know where this is going. Diane's mom rented Faces of Death.
She went back to the school and basically walked past the secretary and went back to the principal's office, and she said, go ahead and get a chair because we're going to watch some movies.
Diane's parents started a lawsuit against the school and asked Sherry's parents to join in, which they did because Sherry had spent the rest of that summer afraid to go outside.
It was like a fear of death. Like, I didn't want to do anything that I could get hurt, or I didn't want to leave the house, and I didn't want to go in a car because I was afraid I was going to get in a car accident, and I kept having these nightmares.
At school, Mr. Schwartz was the cool teacher, so Sherry and Diane's lawsuit did not go over well.
My locker was broken into and trashed. Everything was, like, thrown out all over the ground. At one point, I was at lunch, and they were throwing trash at me, and they were calling me teacher sewer.
They ended up leaving school. Diane transferred, Sherry took the GED. Their parents eventually settled the lawsuit, and Mr. Schwartz received a 10-day suspension. Conan had only been dimly aware of the incident at Escondido. I played him some of Diane and Sherry's tape, and he was pissed. He has a daughter close to the same age that they were.
It's not even X-rated. It's unrated. This teacher almost weaponized Faces of Death. Any child that doesn't want to see something should be able to leave. And why he's showing it to 15-year-olds is beyond me.
But what happened at Escondido High School isn't the most dire episode associated with Faces of Death.
Closing defense arguments today in the trial of a 15-year-old accused of killing a classmate with a baseball bat just for the thrill of it.
Rod Matthews was 14 when he committed this crime in 1986. He told a psychiatric counselor that he decided to do it after watching Faces of Death.
The article says that he...
Jesus, how old was he?
He was 14.
Yeah, I've never heard of this one.
Faces of Death is associated with two other murders as well. Although, to be fair, the connections are tenuous.
I think evil people are evil people, and they're going to commit their crimes no matter what. It makes me feel bad that he said it was Faces of Death that made me do this, but do I believe if Faces of Death was not around, that would have stopped them from doing it? No. And again, maybe that's me in a self-defense mechanism saying, well, I don't believe it's my fault. Maybe it is. I'd hate to think that. There's nothing that could be further from my desire to create the film.
What was your desire then?
To shock people. To scare people. I wasn't thinking, oh, how is a certain part of my audience going to react to this film, and should I do it or not? I was thinking, how can I get the most people packed in a movie theater and make the most money? Frankly, that's what it was about.
Look, me personally, I don't think Faces of Death is a film you can actively like. But I get it. It's shocking. I like being shocked. I like the adrenaline rush. It's cathartic. And I talked about this a lot with Conan.
If it's not your cup of tea, it's not your cup of tea.
Yeah. it is a weird cup of tea. But
it's a totally weird cup of tea. There's no question that it's a weird cup of tea. But it is fascinating.
It gave me a kind of a weird perception of death, I think. Being hit in the face with images of death when you're young and you don't really have the faculties to manage that, I think that it changes how you perceive those things pushing forward.
After high school, Diane and Sherry found themselves drawn to high-intensity situations. In their early 20s, Diane worked a suicide hotline. Sherry sat with family members of people who died unexpectedly. On the weekends, they would borrow a police scanner and drive around, watching the cops respond to calls. Both of them credit Faces of Death for the shift in their lives.
I don't remember having the desire to be involved in things that were so adrenaline-inducing before that. Before that, I volunteered at a daycare center.
That was the first time in my life I realized that, you know, life can be bad. Life wasn't flowery and pretty and nice. Life was ugly. And I took that and went with it.
Sherry even considered becoming a coroner, but decided to go into the military. Diane became a paramedic. She's spent her adulthood living out the kinds of scenes that might appear in Faces of Death.
Oh, just gore and people in their worst moment. You know, I've had brain matter in my hair. Normal people don't. I really don't think they have any idea of the things that paramedics and EMTs see.
When we see things that disturb us, we limit our emotional response to protect ourselves. That's what it means to be desensitized. Diane knows that better than most people.
You learn very quickly to not have any feelings at all. Well, that bleeds over into your normal life. You just don't have feelings. I am not a normal person. You know, when my grandson was born, and I hate to even say this, and I hope that I felt nothing. I looked at everyone else in the room and I saw how they were acting, and that's how I acted too. But I felt nothing. I couldn't feel good or bad.
Okay, so Faces of Death, the film that altered the direction of Diane and Sherry's lives, is, right, mostly fake. But they've gone the past 3 decades thinking it was entirely real. So, like, the monkey brain sequence, for instance, that is completely fake.
Wow.
I didn't know that wasn't real until you told me that when we talked on the phone. I didn't know that. Isn't that awful? I thought it was all real. That was what was so weird about it. I'm like, why are they filming this? Why are they doing this? What is wrong with people?
After the film became this massive international controversy, Conan went on to make three sequels and one greatest hits compilation titled The Worst of Faces of Death. He was still producing TV shows under his real name for clients like the Disney Channel. But Conan's not in LA anymore. A little over a decade ago, he decided to move with his family to Colorado.
I was kind of semi-retired, or semi-retiring, let's say, and wanted to find something to do.
My name is François Jardin. I'm a Harold assassin.
So, remember how Conan appears on screen as a gun-toting French assassin in the first Faces of Death? That was a very deliberate choice.
All the guns, all the ammo, all the stuff you see in the scene was stuff that I personally owned.
He's way into guns.
I've had guns my whole life. I'm around guns. I'm wearing a gun right now.
So when the owner of his favorite gun store in Colorado told him that he was selling the shop, Conan got another crazy idea.
This could be interesting. I said, would you mind entertaining a counter proposal?
No. Yeah, why don't you just give me the tour?
All right, so this little tiny itty.
Conan's shop specializes in tactical gear and firearms, including semi-automatic rifles. The store's logo is a skull.
You can see these are little skulls, and that would take your standard AR-15 and dress it up.
Oh, so they're like accessories for
right.
The AR-15 it's, with skulls on it.
AR-15s are kind of like adult Legos. Because you can change them and dress them up. This one has.
I asked Conan what he thought the connection was between Faces of Death and what he does now, besides the skulls.
Well, I would say because a lot of people don't want to think about death, there's also a lot of people that don't want to think about bad things. I'll give you a good example. My ex-wife says I'm paranoid because I have a gun. And my response is, I'm not paranoid at all. I'm not afraid to go anywhere because the gun is a great equalizer. Many people avoid this because they don't, dark things and evil people, that'll never happen to me. And it happens, and it happens a lot. And it seems in our society happen more often now than it ever did.
A lot of Conan's clientele are in law enforcement. Many of them have seen Faces of Death.
The older guys, they remember it. They remember it showing it in the firehouse or showing it at the police station.
And it's because he sells so much to law enforcement that he's able to stock things like a fully automatic machine gun. It's a floor model for SWAT teams.
Yeah, don't shoot until I say action.
Okay.
Let's put it on full auto because I don't think it's going
to... He took me out to a range so I could shoot it.
Roll in and action. Good job, man.
After we were done, he spent several minutes hunched over his iPhone, editing the videos he took of me shooting and adding a bunch of slow-mo.
Okay, so let me just finish fucking this.
It seems like there's a lot of shootings where people are using these guns, like guns you can buy out there. And, I mean, I don't know. Do you ever have second thoughts or feel any, like...
No, never.
Or
never,
feel responsibility or guilt?
Never have second thoughts about it. Never feel responsible for it. Just relax. Take a deep breath. Let it out. Perfect. This world is a tough place. And there's a lot of bad guys out there.
Like you're squeezing a lemon.
You don't want to take responsibility for your own protection. You think it won't happen to me. How many people have been killed thinking that? I do not see myself as a sheep. I see myself as the sheepdog.
It does give you an adrenaline rush. There's no question.
I carry a gun. I have a permit to do so because I refuse to be a victim. Because I've seen the dark side of humanity. I've made films about the dark side of humanity. And I'm going to be prepared.
it sore.
Big love to our film consultants Spencer Parsons and Todd Wynecki. And special thanks to producers Esther Honig and Catherine Davidici Jaffe. The original score and performance of that score was by our own Renzo Gorio. The story was produced by John Facile.
Oh, snap adapt. So there you go. Snap Judgment's look at the documentary Faces of Death, which I remember seeing in at home on video. And I was also reminded by my father that if this was truly a snuff film or something of an illegal manner, then the store really wouldn't, at least the store we frequented, would not be selling this at all. The police would have something to do with that. So anyway, that is, well, I'm not saying you should go look that up, but if you were a knuckleheaded kid of the 80s, this was a phenomenon. So back in the old VHS days, post Betamax. All right, let's take a short break. And when we come back after the break, I'll talk a little bit about a film I got on Blu-ray this week, just in time for the month of October. Sammy Terry should be on the show in a couple of weeks. So you have to wait for that. And, of course, the Heartland Film Festival is happening. And also be on the lookout for a film called Neither Wolf Nor Dog, which is opening in Brownsburg, I believe, the weekend. Actually, next weekend. So, anyway, just mark your calendars and stick around. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org.
This is Sammy Terry being terrorized with you with film sociology. Have many pleasant nightmares.
Welcome back to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Socey. Just a friendly reminder, note that the music you heard during the break is music from the 1972 cult. Everything. Just because it's old doesn't mean it's a classic, but I enjoy the hell out of it. But from the 1972 film Blackula, starring the great William Marshall in the title role, I recently revisited this film and Scream Blackula Scream because of my involvement in a production of Dracula, which is happening at Richmond Civic Theater. And because Blackula's been on my mind, let's share some audio with you. Enjoy.
You shall. Black Prince, I bless you with my name. You shall be Blackula.
Blackula, the Black Avenger, rising from his tomb to fill the night with horror. Blackula, Dracula's soul brother. Deadlier even than he.
You know, he is a strange dude.
You're the nut that ran in front of my cab. You're the only imbecile on this street. Boy.
Blackula.
Look at man, you find I mean, he's got to be around here somewhere. I mean, now listen, you take your hands off of me. I don't know you.
He thirsts for your blood. He hungers for your soul. Warm young bodies will feed his hunger. Hot, fresh blood will quench his awful thirst.
Make it a Bloody Mary. Are you into the occult?
No!
How about the heavy stuff?
What do you think of vampires?
Vampires? I think they're possibly the most fascinating of all.
More horrifying than Dracula. The Black Avenger. Blackula. From American International Pictures.
So, there you go. I just enjoy those. I've been a fan of the Blaxploitation era most of my life, and I actually got set anyway. But what I love about the film is, on paper, yes, it's silly. It's a black vampire movie from the 70s, but your anchor, your the main reason to see this is William Marshall, a classically trained stage actor who also did films like Demetrius and the Gladiators and the Boston Strangler. And Abdul will tell you about his, he's also in one of the best episodes of Star Trek, playing a mad scientist. And yes, he was also the king of cartoons on Pee-wee's Playhouse. But this was a corner. He also had his own acting company. He toured for years as doing a one-man show of Thurgood Marshall. I have a DVD of Marshall playing Othello opposite Ron Moody as Iago, and he treats Blackula like it's King Lear. And there is a tragic aspect of the Dracula story, depending on if you want to share that side or not. It's in the novel. But anyway, I enjoy it very much so. But that's not why you called. That's not why I – that was not the film I was going to bring up. But new on DVD and Blu-ray this week, I got sent a Blu-ray copy, a two-disc collection from Scream Factory. That's the offshoot of Shout Factory. 1977's Exorcist II: The Heretic, and I'm still going through the commentaries, yes, I am that guy, including one by Mike White, who has been on this program as a guest, and there is the original director's cut, which is a little under 2 hours, and then the international theatrical version, which was about an hour and 40 minutes, This film is known for a lot of things. It's directed by John Borman. Of course, it brought back Linda Blair and Kitty Wynn and Max von Sydow. But you also had Richard Burton, Louise Fletcher, James Earl Jones. Ned Beatty had a small role in it. And it's 4 years after the first Exorcist film, and she's still having dreams. She's still having nightmares, but doesn't want to talk about it. And then there's this whole thing of hypnosis and getting into each other's dreams or psyches, and it's a mess of a film, but it's not nearly as bad as people put it out to be. Now, I also read about Exorcist II: The Heretic because in the book, The Golden Turkey Awards, written by the Medved brothers, which I believe was published in the early 80s, they named this film runner-up as the worst film of all time, the winner, of course, being Ed Wood's Plan 9 from Outer Space. And it's not that bad. And of course, this is a book that's, you know, over 35 years old. So there's been a lot worse out there, and that's another discussion for another time on is it really awful. You know, The Room was bad filmmaking, but I enjoy it. But that's neither here nor there for the moment. But anyway, but what Borman was trying to do with the film, as well as writer William Goodhart, and then the studio put their paws into things, and producers and executives, and it turns into a fumbling mess, especially when you're following up something as strong as the original Exorcist. And John Borman didn't want it to be called Exorcist 2. He just wanted to call it The Heretic. One of the commentaries, there are three of these, one by Borman, one by Mike White, and the other by a third gentleman whose name eludes me at the moment. Sorry, I'll try to make up for that next week. But his suggestion is watching The Exorcist, then The Exorcist 3, then Exorcist 2, and there's a more through line. The original Exorcist 2 was supposed to follow the Lee J. Cobb character, the police detective, who George C. Scott plays in Exorcist 3. And of course, Lee J. Cobb died, so they wound up scurrying and having Burton play the role of a priest who knew the Max von Sydow character. Louise Fletcher comes in as a doctor. So there were some good ideas, and it was also Warner Brothers wanted it cheaply shot, and so most of it is shot on location or in a studio in Los Angeles, some shots in New York, and then some other stuff that's really so not Africa and for production design. But anyway, I'm still going through those. I'll talk about this film a little more next week. But yeah, it is not the runner-up for the worst film ever made. It's unfortunate, and there was a severe backlash of the film when it was released. It still made money, but not to the degree of the first film, and it was not a film that anybody, apparently audiences did not want this. They wanted another version of The Exorcist. So anyway, we'll get to that in hopefully more next week. Also new on video this week, sometimes my curiosity gets the worst of me, and I wonder, well, how bad can this be? Because I believe it got a 0 on Rotten Tomatoes, and that really doesn't matter much, but, you know, getting a goose egg is of some interest. But I think there needs to be a break taken with the mob film. And I say that because I watched Gotti, or as it says on the cover, Travolta is Gotti. No, he's not. And this is watching this, and it's a story of New York crime lord John Gotti, which Travolta is really, really trying hard on this one. And it also splices in actual news footage, and then the film itself. And it's one thing to put the images of the real person who is the subject of the film maybe at the end of the film, for instance, What's Love Got to Do with It, but to have it spliced in throughout, that's distracting. It's also directed by one of the guys from Entourage, and it feels like, if you remember Scary Movie and Epic Movie and Not So Teen, you know, all of the parody films, this felt like at times Mob Movie. And the snark that I used to say with Kobe was here was, you know, this is a really good mob film if you've never seen a mob film before in your life. That's not even true here. It goes down the story, the checklist as far as what you need in a mob film. Overindulgent Italian acting, betrayal, rise, violence, little family life, good family life, bad family life. And Travolta chewing scenery. So yeah, this was really not a fun experience. And I like mob films. And by the way, you can't use The Animals' House of the Rising Sun, because I immediately think of the use of that song in Martin Scorsese's Casino. Scorsese can use Gimme Shelter 3 times in 3 different films, but not a good sign if you're using music from another film about organized crime, and that's where your mind goes. So be careful with that. Also new on Blu-ray, you have on Criterion, Sidney Poitier's Raisin in the Sun. Also on Blu-ray, the beautiful, lovely film, The Trip to Bountiful. And this story has a special place in my heart because I've directed the play twice. Great performance by Geraldine Page. John Hurd, Rebecca De Mornay are also in that film. If you need it on Blu-ray, The Swarm is now on Blu-ray. So, and as I said before, Exorcist 2, The Heretic. All right, we have a few minutes left. Let's go see what's happening at IU Cinema. Liquid Sky at 7 o'clock, and She Done Him Wrong at 4 o'clock on Saturday the 29th. Sunday the 30th, Love Is Potatoes at 1 o'clock, Zabriskie Point at 4 o'clock. Monday the 1st, Personal Problems at 7 p.m. Wednesday, October 3rd, One Vote at 3 o'clock. Thursday, October 4th, Rising Tide, The Crossroads Project live performance at 7 o'clock. And for your double feature on Friday, October 5th, Without a Clue at 7 o'clock and at 10 o'clock, The Valley of Guanji. Wow. And then Five Fingers of Marseilles at 4 o'clock and The Hound of the Baskervilles at 7 o'clock on Saturday, August 6th. I love IU Cinema. That's just fun. All right, over at the Tibbs Drive-In, Night School and the Predator, Smallfoot and Crazy Rich Asians, Hellfest and The Nun, The House with a Clock in Its Walls, and The Meg. Okay, waiting for the kids to go to sleep. And at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville, here's one, Smallfoot at 8 o'clock, 1986's Little Shop of Horrors at 10 o'clock. Good choice. Nice one there. At the Historic Artcraft Theater in Franklin tonight at 7:30 p.m., Ghostbusters. On Tuesday, October 2nd, doors open at 6 o'clock. The film's at 7 o'clock. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Psycho on Friday and Saturday, October 5th and 6th, 2 and 7:30 p.m. And then Tuesday, October 9th, Alamar, with the movie at 7 o'clock. And don't forget, at the Keystone Arts Cinema, starting next week, is the Midnight Movie Series, Fridays and Saturdays at midnight, October 5th and 6th, the original Hills Have Eyes from Wes Craven, October 12th and 13th, you have House, the Japanese film, on October 19th and 20th, Evil Dead 2, and on October 26th and 27th, the 30th anniversary of Beetlejuice. So there you go. Midnight movies for you. Also a reminder that Bardfest is happening this weekend and next weekend. So go to Bardfest Indy. They have a Facebook page. I believe they have a website. But of course, I had a bunch of the people involved with those shows. Romeo and Juliet, Merchant of Venice, Much Ado About Nothing, and Midsummer Night's Dream. All of those are happening around Indianapolis. So, and once again, Richmond Civic Theater's production of Dracula, October 19th and 20th and 26th through the 28th. Those are 7:30 p.m. shows, as well as a 2:30 matinee on the final performance. You can go to gorct.org for information. And thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
There's another weird John Borman film. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. And thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting WFYI. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!